It's indeed a great pleasure to be here. Until this year, I was living in Indianola, but I am now a full-time resident. In fact, just a few blocks away. And I've always been intrigued by cooperative movements like co-housing and intentional communities. I was thinking of a kind of distant relationship to Bush and Katrina a couple of days ago. Let me try this out on you. It reminded me, I trust some of you into fairy tales who will remember the Emperor's clothes, new clothes. And there was an emperor, a very vain guy, that commanded his tailors to come up with something new, the best. And it goes through a series of things of using gold that's ever and ever finer. But he's really naked, and only an intrepid, innocent young lad, as the king is walking in his earliest garb, says the king is naked. And the other people, of course, were quite astonished. Well, I think there's a connection to Bush, because I think it has taken something of a colossal disaster nature to bring out certain basic features that some of us intuited before, but we are seeing it in full display. But there is one important difference, I think, and that is, whereas in the fairy tale, there's just one unusual kid that sees reality for what it is, I think that there has been excellent reportage. Of course, you have to read somewhere between the lines or extend some of the lines, but this is the first period that I remember since the Vietnam War that a lot of the unvarnished truth about America has come out, and even the language changed. Like one word that is barely ever used, and always in a pejorative sense when it is the word class. We talk about other things, even racism. Specialists talk about that all the time. But class is one of those hidden words. And for the rulers that be, it's probably in their interests that very few people use it. Because class suggests that there's conflict. And so then you're led to explore this. What is the nature of conflict? Is it something connected with the structure of the system or just human beings in general? And I think that Black people have understood that our system has had an intertwining of race and class for a very, very long period. Goes back to when Blacks first arrived in 1619. There was a period of the construction of the Virginia colony. Well, for an interim period of maybe several decades, the Blacks and the whites were in a similar class position. They were both indentured servants to a small elite from England that had brought them to America and controlled the colony. And there was a good deal of fraternization. In many cases, they ran away together. But it was in the interests of the ruling class to develop racism, to push it strongly, because it enabled them to reduce Blacks to a permanent class of slavery, which fitted in very well with their needs for a stable, low-wage working class, agricultural working class, in turning out tobacco. So they were material roots. In any case, when what the writers of the recent disaster have pointed out reveals something of the background and yet something new. What we see, for example, is that capitalism is even more myopic than many people thought. It has come out again and again that they were technically trained people that said, we are possibly in for trouble if we don't improve the system of levies. In other words, it was known in advance that there had to be an investment in order to save the people in case of disaster. And that has been pointed out by innumerable writers, and we can see it in the local paper. Even the Seattle Weekly had a long and interesting section. In addition, what we see, and this is where a combination of class and race was involved, was that in order, once the levees had broken, the city was virtually underwater, it was necessary to evacuate the people who did not have cars to get out. Who were they? Lo and behold, 134,000 of them, according to the estimate I read, were black people, you know, who were too poor to have cars, therefore were dependent on public transportation. And lo and behold, they found out that the system was really quite callous in regard to saving that many people, the vast, vast majority of whom were black and poor. And poverty and color go together, not 100% though. And that is that a little over 12% of the total population are in poverty. It's defined by economists in various ways. But believe me, if anything, real poverty is higher than the official level. Of that number, a highly disproportionate number, about 24%, 25%, were black and Hispanic, and a little over 10% were white. So what we see is that blacks are class divided the same way whites are class divided, but the proportions are different. And that is, blacks are overrepresented in the low income category, and whites are overrepresented. But since the vast majority of the population is white rather than black, certainly a significant majority of poor people, for example, are white. Now, this doesn't tell you anything about their psychological perception of themselves, because there's been a brilliant effort, as you undoubtedly know, for whites to feel superior in many, many ways over blacks. And so consciousness is not a mirror image of objective reality concerning the distribution of income or wealth. But nevertheless, we see that in America, and particularly in the South, that blacks and whites face a similar class composition, a class-divided society. And when we look at New Orleans, we see that behind the glitzy picture of jazz in the beautiful historic French Quarter and the fancy stores on Canal Street, that there is the opposite, a large part of the population that were mired in poverty. Now, there are various theories of poverty that have been developed. And for example, what conservatives say is that poverty is a function of the individual. That is, the poor have created a culture of poverty. They, instead of putting their nose to the grindstone, they go to the gin mills. Instead of getting educated, they live in the streets or are involved in crime. And this is an idea, by the way, that goes back to the early 1800s. A man by the name of Malthus said, and this is almost a quote, "The plight of the poor is due to themselves, not the institutions of society, but bad choices." And just in case you think that this is a quaint old theory, a man that got the Nobel Prize in economics has written on racism and concluded that racism is an attitude, and that the nature of capitalism is that it puts unremitting pressure on capitalists to abandon racism. Why? Because if you're an intelligent capitalist and you hire only on the basis of reducing your costs, why would you hire higher-priced people over lower-priced? And so in his scenario, capitalism breaks down racism by forcing capitalists to be competitive. If you want a dissection of that, look at my book, Political Economy of Racism, the chapter on chapter 4 on conservatives and liberals. I have something further to say about liberals a little later. Oh, in fact, the liberal view of poverty is somewhat different, yet retains some of the mindset of conservatives. And that is, the liberal says that government has a crucial role because it is needed to break up the continuity of poverty from one generation to the next. It has to break up the poverty cycle. And but it wants to retain the basic institutions that have created poverty. So what they are saying is, rather than the completely free market, we need more of a guided market. Private property, to be sure. Private profit, to be sure. But there has to be a role of the government to make the system somewhat more stable and somewhat more equitable without violating the basic structures of society. That's a no-no. To do that, you have to join the radicals. And we have a political structure that reflects these economic realities. We have conservatives in the Republican Party that have no shame about increasing inequality, because to them, the capitalist class are the innovators, the people that are responsible for progress. If you want the best source for taking that concept to the very end of the line, look at some of Ayn Rand. also in the form of novels, or Milton Friedman. Both of them are a formidable combination. They are in some ways the godfather of Bush's economic policies, but with an important distinction. What Bush favors, and he gets this from the neoconservatives, is a diminished role for the government as concerns welfare for the poor. You want to make them more responsible. Since they are responsible in a totality for their own condition, let's force it on them. Why give them food stamps, subsidize this or that? Let them earn it. And Clinton was quite proud of himself when he reduced the welfare laws in his reign by presenting a new concept of welfare that diminished the number of years that you could get it. In any way, the Democrats represent that kind of new pragmatism. You don't defend capitalism on ideological grounds, but you defend it on the grounds that it exists and you want it and functions relatively effectively, and you want it to operate more effectively so that there's less opposition. And they, it's hard to tell where they stand on this Operation Katrina, because they've been relatively silent. What they seem to be saying, as I understand it, is that it's a dreadful shame, and if we are in power, we will deal with it more effectively. Something pretty similar to their position on the Iraq War, where there, perhaps not for all the best reasons, but if we're to introduce democracy and the free market, that we have to stay the course, but we have to do it intelligently and effectively. And democracy then is when you have these two vital parties competing with each other, whereas for us, or at least the way I look at it, the lesser of two evils translates into choosing between who will misrepresent you more and who will misrepresent you less. I consider that a rather limited view of democracy, but it seems to function. To function in terms of hasn't yet created enough resistance to overthrow it. To understand the effect of Hurricane Katrina, I think that it's most effective if we look at what normal capitalism was, defining normal as pre-Katrina. You know, in what ways did it differ from what's going on now? Well, I would say that normal capitalism has very significant inequality. It has to. Why? Because it's functionally necessary to have inequality for a private profit system to function. If it was equal, then who would invest? And this is the traditional line that's given by economists or politicians that want to show the virtues of the system. So it wasn't Katrina that created inequality. Just as it's not racism that by itself that creates poverty. So the basic feature that existed then, that would exist under normal capitalist conditions, is that workers get hired, and the goal of the capitalist in hiring them is for these workers to produce more value than they receive back in the form of wages. Now, this, whether this is sinful or good or productive, that depends on your system of values. But I think it's a fact of life. That is, capitalists hire workers in expectation of getting a return. Now, so that's a second thing that existed under pre-Katrina conditions. A third thing, of course, is the position of blacks themselves. They before Katrina, were receiving about under 60% of what white people were receiving. There was a polarization of wealth and power in America, and they were on the short end of the stick in terms of health, education, standard of living, and, of course, power and wealth. Now, again, blacks are a class-divided race, the same way whites are. When we look at average figures for blacks and whites, we tend to pass over the fact that there is a class society that each of them fit into. Now, of course, it's not a mirror image of each other. But if every black receives the wage or return, we'll call it, because then it can include profit, got exactly the same return as the whites, they would be exchanging a position of unequal exploitation for equal exploitation. In other words, they would be like the average worker who produces more value than he receives. So what we see with Katrina is that it's brought to the surface a very sharp appreciation of the fact that we are a society with a deeply interrelated class and race structure. And that's very important, I think, for an understanding of what has happened in New Orleans in the face of dealing with a natural catastrophe, and moreover, what will be done in the future. I'll give you a little footnote on this. A month before Katrina, there was a hurricane that hit Cuba, Hurricane Dennis, and same Category 4, you know, which is a devastating level. About like a half a million people were moved. Only 16 people died. This is a country that's much weaker than ours, much poorer than ours, under continual pressure from the United States. I'm not glorifying everything in Cuba, but I am saying that by its nature of being a non-profit-motivated society, that it was able to galvanize resources in a critical situation in a way that our system can't. And I think it's worth reflecting on, because one of the questions we want to ask is, what are the possibilities of our system in terms not only of handling hurricanes, which, by the way, according to the ecologists I read is going to increase in number in the next couple of decades as a result of some of the man-made pollution. So we want to have a look at what can capitalism do? Is it progressive at all? Can it overcome poverty? Can it redistribute income and still be capitalism? And the answer is it can, to a certain degree. And we can see, for example, that in the New Deal period, that Social Security was developed, unemployment insurance was developed, unions were recognized. There was a considerable increase in welfare. Now, one of the interesting questions is, why doesn't it continue? Why doesn't it go further? Why, for example, is the economic position of blacks deteriorating now? It hasn't always deteriorated. In the 60s, the gap between whites and blacks narrowed. In fact, that continued through part of the 70s. But it slightly improved in the 90s. And that has not only stopped, but it is moving in the other direction. Well, see, capitalism is both efficient and inefficient. On a micro level, it is probably the most efficient system that has existed. And that is, if a capitalist is trying to make a buck, he's going to put every effort at reducing his costs. And so on that micro level, the use of resources, the combination of machines and human beings, is likely to be very effective. But this micro-efficiency can be more than overcome by what I would call social inefficiency. And that is, we are always in a stage of the business cycle. Boom and bust. As some of you probably found out a few years ago, if you had even a modest amount invested in the market or worked for a firm in which you had a retirement, because a lot of that has been badly affected. In any case, since production is geared for profit, if there's a perception that we are, for some reason, entering into a period of a lack of sufficient profitability, capitalists slow down their investments, and the economy goes into a tailspin. How do we explain that in terms of efficiency? Well, what I would say is that on a macro level, looking at the economy as a whole, that's highly inefficient if you have idle people and idle factories, if you're turning out less than you're capable of turning out. Now, bring that closer to the present. What we are witnessing now is an incredible globalization of the world. And how does that affect poverty and affluence? It affects it very directly because capitalists have sharply reduced employment in manufacturing. It has gone to other countries with lower wage costs. Perfectly reasonable. But it leaves devastation in its wake, almost like the hurricane leaving devastation in its wake. And what this adds up to is that you have a great increase in social efficiency when you have this unplanned investment cycle, when the capitalists have to invest in order to stay competitive, because there's a fierce war going on between the capitalists in different countries. One of the great advantages, for example, that our capitalists were bequeathed by the government in the invasion of Iraq is that it opened up that country to American investment. Now, whether or not that's the reason we went into, liberals, conservatives, and radicals will argue about, and we won't deal with that now. But it's clear that when some of the European countries would not follow the line of America, it's because it was a threat to their investments. The French have invested for quite some time in Iraq, and they saw some of the handwriting on the wall. So there is peaceful, thus far, peaceful competition between capitalists in different countries. And what this creates is an incredible increase in inequality, because you have a number of people that have lost jobs, as it has been put out to other countries, and they are forced to accept jobs in the lower paying, ununionized service sector. And you have some of the smaller capitalists being cut out of the game. And the end result is an economy in which a rising share goes to capital, a falling share goes to labor. Does it mean that all workers are hurt? Of course not. Not any more than that all capitalists gain. But the evidence, very clear, comes out of our own documents, shows that there has been a very rapid rise in inequality and a rise in unemployment. Not every year, because even if there is a general decline, you may have cyclical upswings that have a temporary rising effect. But what we are witnessing in connection with natural disasters, like the Katrina hurricane, is a change in the direction of capitalism, an acceleration of the hard-nosed guys, and a deceleration of the soft people. Instead of the idea that reforms are crucial to capitalism and that therefore the role of government is to make those reforms which are necessary for survival, we now have a dominant idea, not held by everybody, that we are engaged in economic combat, and that economic combat means that we have to reduce costs. And the way to reduce costs is through reducing the use of high-priced labor and replacing it with low-priced labor. Now, somewhere along the line, there's going to be a crisis. Maybe not tomorrow or the next day. But if you keep pushing down on wages and increasing the share that the capitalists get, who's going to buy the goods that are turned out? And so that's not the only reason for a business crisis, but it is one of them. And so what we see with Katrina is a strong effect of racism on both the process and both the cause and the process that accompanies it. And we see that the gap between the whites and the blacks is even more intense. and that in crises, a disproportionate share of the burden is borne by the weakest group, the whites, the blacks, and those whites that are lower income, less skilled workers. So then the question is, well, what can we do about it? What's the, if we've diagnosed this correctly, especially the proneness of an unplanned system to have an acceleration of problems, an acceleration of crises, can it be at least ameliorated, as reformists would like? Well, what we see is that we have waves of reformists and ideologues of the right. And it's reflected in the political process. And we've had our modest reformers and solid reformers, soft reactionaries and hard reactionaries. But what we have seen over the last 25 years is that the axis, the middle, the average, has moved to the right. That is, the Democrats of line of the past has moved closer to the pure capitalist line. Is that happenstance? Granted that the right is going to have a hard time winning the next election, that may not be as significant as you might think. Culturally, it may be somewhat better, because it's quite clear that part, the political part of this economic agenda of making income more unequal, giving all sorts of advantages to capitalists, cutting down on the welfare state, politically appears to have moved the Republicans towards more and more of a controlled state, of making it more difficult for even liberal views to be heard, no less radical views. So, they may be moving in a dimension that I had when I was younger, and that is the McCarthy direction. Because at a certain crucial point, there is bound to be a reaction on the part of the majority to a process by which their own exploitation is being increased, supposedly for their own benefit, via some kind of trickle-down notion. Namely, the idea that if the capitalists get more income, they'll invest more, there'll be more growth, and little by little, everybody will gain. But when the figures for any given year show that instead of a rising tide lifting all ships, which is what we did have for some years, we now have what someone called a race to the bottom. And in that situation, with some exceptions, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Now, is that a tenable position for any length of time? Well, this is where racism comes in and is so important. Because if the white worker thinks that he or she has more in common with the white capitalist than he has with his black counterpart, the capitalist can smile all the way to the bank. And so racism becomes an important feature of a society that has reached a stage of global crisis. Now, when I say global crisis, I don't mean that all of the countries are going to implode. That's not true. Some are growing quite rapidly, namely India and what we might call state capitalism in China, which is a kind of, well, Lenin would roll over in his grave, but what you see is a so-called radical party moving ever so rapidly towards capitalism and having an extraordinary rate of growth that is sustainable only as long as workers there accept the extraordinary rate of exploitation. And you also have well over 100 million people unemployed, perhaps more. Some people think it's at least 10%. But there is an unevenness of development. And what we see is that while there is an increase in inequality within America, that's nothing compared to the increase in inequality between nations. Between nations, it's of a truly gross form. Someone estimated that the income, you know the difference between income and wealth. Income is per year, wealth is your accumulated income. Someone computed that the income of 300 some odd wealthiest people in the world had an income equal to the lowest 1.2 or 3 billion people. Now that's really extraordinary. You know, it gives you an idea of the number of people that go to bed hungry every day. And so will people ever react to that kind of grossness? We don't know. But I think that we are at a fork in the road. And that in order to enforce the current regime with the current distribution of income, and especially with the current level of racism, that ultimately more and more force will be needed. One way we have been moving in that position is the growth of prisons. It's like our way of solving the housing crisis. It's a growth industry, the biggest growth industry in the country. Is it accidental that it's occurring now? I think not, because if I'm correct about this growing inequality, growing resentment, growing crime, which after all, for some people, is an effort to redistribute income. With all of that, there's going to be some reaction against the existing state of affairs. And if you desire to maintain the existing state of affairs, you certainly need to have prison control. And there's a racial angle to that. Because blacks are now approaching 50% of the prisoners. We're number one in the world, by the way, over 2 million. Not quite like the old Soviet gulag system, but moving in that direction. It means, someone calculated, that a quarter of black male population will be in prison in some time during their life. Well, that's kind of extraordinary. And I would think that black men, at least, would be radicalized by that, unless they induce themselves to think that somehow they're going to escape. So I think that the class lines are hardening in America. I think there is some re-evaluation going on. I think people are beginning to raise questions. And I think that change in America has to go beyond the Tweedledee-Tweedledum parties. I think people have to begin asking themselves questions about what kind of quality of life do they want, and is it supplied by an aggrandizing, private profit, profit-maximizing system. Now, we don't know what the alternative will be. We do know that the efforts that have been made to create a contrary system have not worked. I am in no sense a believer in the old Soviet system. In fact, I think that it essentially broke down because of the lack of internal democracy. But we are passing ourselves off as a democracy when democracy at its highest level means control by the producers of wealth over what they have chosen to produce and chosen how to distribute. In that sense, we are a formal political democracy, having political choices, but within what I would call, you may not agree with me, economic despotism. Because last time I looked, workers had no choice over what was produced, they had no choice over income, and that their wealth accumulation, on average, was modest. And so we're approaching a fork in the road where I think that we are headed for crises. And the value of Katrina is that it, in its wake, I believe, has come some rethinking. It's not by itself going to change things. It's not going by itself to produce a new cooperative democratic society that I personally would favor. But I think what we are seeing is that Katrina was an example of market failure. And what is failing in New Orleans is beginning to fail all over. That the real beneficiaries of capitalism are small in number, and that the people hurt by it are a growing number of humanity. Therefore, I would say, and I'll conclude on this, that the next stage of the development of human beings and human society has to be to transcend a society that has become more and more inadequate for human beings, and to start the difficult road of creating a different society where, for the first time, human beings will be capable of becoming all that they can. Thank you.